KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. I'm speaking to director James Hawes about his film One Life, which tells the story of Sir Nicholas Winton, who organized the rescue of more than 600 mostly Jewish children as the Nazis marched toward Czechoslovakia. The film portrays Winton as a 29-year-old, played by actor and musician Johnny Flynn, and as a 79-year-old with Sir Anthony Hopkins in the role. I know that Barbara had expressed this wish to have Anthony Hopkins do that role. How did you manage to arrange it?
Well, yeah, I mean, she literally handed over the book and the rights to the producers and said, there is a condition, you need to get Anthony Hopkins to be my dad. And she wrote a letter to him personally. That was some years ago. And then it's a process. It's credit to Lucinda Cox and then Nick Drake, who wrote the script. It's credit to the producers who maintained the dialogue with Anthony and his team. And then I flew out and met with Anthony. It was supposed to be an hour and a half's breakfast. 4 hours later, we thought we'd better stop talking and get on with the rest of our day. But we'd established a mood. We knew we wanted to tell the same type of story. We'd come up with a tone word, and the tone word was restraint. And we felt that keeping that held back emotion, it's a story so full of emotion that it didn't need sugar and syrup poured all over it. And we wanted that understatement, which, of course, Tony, as he would want to be called, does so brilliantly, to play throughout, not just in performance, but in the way the camera moved, in the music. And I like to think that's what's become part of the hallmark of the film.
Yes, I don't know how obviously, Anthony Hopkins is one of the greatest actors alive or ever. But I wonder how much time he spent and how he figured out how to be Nicky when Nicky was no longer in the world.
Research is a huge thing for Tony. So he talks about living with the script is more important. It's more important to live with it long than to know it well. He will read and reread it and reread it. He makes comments and raises questions on every reading. He listens to everything he could find from Nicky. And then he puts that aside. And then he tries to absorb it. So the performance must, as any great actor, come from in to out rather than with bolt-ons. And then we worked around the rehearsal table. We brought in gradually the other actors, including Johnny Flynn, who's playing the younger version of Nicky. And I think then you just watch the master at work. It's quite something for a director, and it's happened to me a handful of times, where you start running the camera and something almost physical seems to happen to the person, and the tone of their voice shifts and the way they move shifts, and they become that character.
Yes, he was the right man. And I imagine having him made it easier to bring in other actors like Helena Bonham Carter and Lena Olin.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It's that the process of casting. You get that central piece and then you've got an Anthony Hopkins and they create a kind of gravitational pull for the rest of the cast. Helena Bonham Carter, I've been lucky enough to work in the past, the same with Johnny Flynn. But, you know, parts like Lena Olin and Marta Keller, who are great actors in their own right, they're not huge, but partly because of the nature of the story and the nature of Tony Hopkins, they were willing to come on board and bring their brilliance to the same project.
I wish I could ask him what he made him take that role. I mean, obviously, it's a great role and a great story, but I wonder what particular thing spoke to him. Did he ever mention it to you in the four-hour conversation?
Yeah, he does. There are a couple of things he talks about. He talks about some of the emotions, the fact that there is an emotional journey for that character, from having the burden of guilt and grief to some sort of discovery and redemption and catharsis. And that's powerful for an actor and for a director to be able to take the leading man through that. It's about emotions he discovered in the story, like compassion. He talks a lot about compassion and what he feels is the lack of it today. He talked about selflessness, and that idea that it is the polar opposite of the Insta generation. This is about somebody doing something because it's the right thing to do. And he also tells the story of remembering one particular man when he was growing up who had fought in the war with the British Army and had been one of the soldiers who'd been first into Belsen when the camp was relieved. And the memories and the stories that that man brought home. So I think all of that made it a film that mattered to him. And he speaks about it very passionately in those terms. We did, God, the world's such a bleak place at the moment, and we would never have wanted it to be so, and we certainly don't want it to look like we're trying to harness the ghastliness for our film, but my God, it speaks pretty powerfully right now to the way we are.
Yes, I don't have to work hard to imagine what Nikki would think about the way refugees are treated and other things. He would have been absolutely horrified. So I don't know how familiar you are with my family's particular story, because, you know, everybody had a story. But, you know, my mother and her sisters came from a remote village, Tristana, which is pretty much the middle of nowhere, and 300 miles from Prague. I don't think my grandparents ever came anywhere near Prague. And, you know, one of the stories that's told often was the way that my grandmother, when she took the children to the station, kept the youngest, put her on the train. She put my Aunt Ellie, who is 10 years old, and I will note is standing along with my other Aunt Yoshi directly behind Nikki and the That's Life show and the part of the group that stands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my mother would say, keep her at the station while your poor mother was agonizing. And at the last minute, she put this 10-year-old on the train. And the daughter of that 10-year-old was the model for the sculpture that's dedicated to this Kindertransport in Liverpool Street Station. So it all connects, you know. And I really want to, if you'll indulge me, I want to read a letter that my grandmother sent to her daughters when they were in this foreign country where she didn't speak the language. And I just want to share that, if you don't mind.
Please.
Seder evening was lovely once upon a time when everyone was seated around the table. Father always at the head, and on either side, I, your mother, and you, my children. Eyes shining with happiness. Life was beautiful. That's how it was before, and that's how it was last year, but this year you are not here. Fate has forced us to send you to a foreign land. Thank God your letters bring us good tidings, but your empty seats embrace us with their emptiness. Another Seder came. We sat down around the table. There are only a few of us, father, mother, and also your old granny, whom fate forced from her home, her familiar place, her children scattered, helter-skelter, cruel fate touched us all. A great distance separates us. We think of you, and you, dear children, think of us at the same moment. We know that we are linked in thought and prayer, in our hearts, the firm belief that the time will come when we will see each other again. It will be like before, but a little different, for you will have grown up, and we, awaiting this precious moment, will have aged. It will be beautiful as it once was. We shall sit around the Seder table again to celebrate our historic escape. Don't despair, children, fathers and mothers and all others. The time will come when our suffering will end. And of course, that time never came when they were gathered again, because my mother and her sisters never saw their parents again. And I imagine, having made this film, that resonates for you as almost maybe as much as it does for us.
It resonates incredibly powerfully. And obviously, I don't have that heritage and that history. But you can imagine that making this film, living with this film for 2 years, with the stories and the stories beyond what is on the screen that have been told to me, stories about survival, because, and I want any audience to understand, as I hope you feel as well, this isn't a wholly bleak film. This is a film about survival, about the triumph of human spirit. And it is eventually uplifting because of, frankly, Kim, people like you who are out there now who wouldn't otherwise be. So it's such a testament to human strength that is expressed in the letter you've just read. And this story will now be part of my life, writ through me like a stick of rock for the rest of my being.
James Hawes is the director of One Life. The film is in theaters now. Thank you so much for joining today.
It's a great pleasure. It's lovely to be here and talking with you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Phil Richards and Nick Lamponi, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.